Juice Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome once more to the program, and may it bring you inspiration and joy. We are circumambulating Shanti Davies' A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Chapter 8, the chapter on meditation. I say circumambulating because we're not exactly following a traditional explanation of the text. If you want that, you should read Kunzang Peldon's The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech. In this program, we are taking a more meandering path, with illuminations and illustrations taken from wherever we can find them. Also, if you think this chapter of the text is a manual on how to meditate, you'll be disappointed. Although the chapter is titled Meditation, Shanti Deva was teaching to an assembly of monks well-versed in the basics of meditation, and many of whom were accomplished meditators. So in this chapter, he focuses on the meditation topic, how to exchange self for others. This, of course, doesn't mean how to put oneself physically in the body of someone else, but rather the technique of exchanging the attitude of me first, me foremost, we are all so accustomed to you first and foremost, the you here being singular or plural as demanded by the situation. In steering us away from attachment to ourselves, and particularly our body, in last week's program, Shanti Deva pointed out how such attachment often leads us into harmful actions, such as killing. And if love of our body can lead us even to killing our parents, he finally asks, why shouldn't we start viewing this body as an enemy rather than a friend? If our problem is attachment to the body, shouldn't we rather learn to despise it and see it as an enemy? Therefore, what wise man would desire to protect and venerate this body? Who would not scorn it and regard it as an enemy, he writes. Now, assuming that the translation is accurate, is this logic sound? I'm not sure that turning attachment to such intense dislike is really a solution, for taken to its logical conclusion, we should then praise the monk who cut off his penis because he had an erection during meditation. I rather prefer what Thich Nhat Hanh wrote in Touching Peace, Practicing the Art of Mindful Living. Keeping your body healthy is an expression of gratitude to the whole cosmos, the trees, the clouds, everything. And following Thich Nhat Hanh, if we look deeply into dependent arising, we see our body is an expression in this point of time of everything down from the Big Bang, and despising it is like despising all of creation. And against the point that samsara is suffering and should be despised, I will ask you to show me the difference between samsara and nirvana. When the Buddha became enlightened, what was the difference between his unenlightened body and his body in enlightenment? As we said last week, and as many texts point out, this body is our ferry from here to enlightenment. So despising it seems hardly necessary, while caring for it, but without attachment, is surely what the Buddha taught. In any case, that's where we got up to last week. And now before we continue with the text, let's set our motivation as we usually do. Please, if you can, set a bodhicitta motivation. That is, to gain enlightenment so we can best benefit all living beings. For that's the greatest purpose we can have. But if that's not within your grasp, at least think of attaining your own liberation from all dissatisfaction and suffering. Thank you. Now, in the next verse, Shantideva gives a rather priceless argument for generosity and not regarding anything as belonging to oneself. He says, "If I give this, what shall I have left to enjoy? Such selfish thinking is the way of ghosts. If I enjoy this, what shall I have left to give? Such selfless thinking is a quality of the gods. Now, say I have a little money and you came and asked me for it. I could think, if I give my money to you, I won't have enough for myself, and so I won't be able to enjoy myself so much. Well, thinking like this, Shantideva says, is the way of the hungry ghosts, whose main psychological defect is miserliness. Shantideva is implying that with such thinking, we will suffer the fate of the hungry ghosts and land up with no enjoyment at all. Often it is very difficult for hungry ghosts to get resources like food and drink and so on, but even if they do, they cannot be satisfied. Some hungry ghosts are even very wealthy, but are not contented. While ferociously hoarding what they have, they are always looking for more. And where have we heard that story before? However, if I think, if I use this for myself, my own enjoyment, what will there be left for you to enjoy? And so if I give you the money, Shantideva says, I will be thinking like someone who lives in luxurious happiness without any lack whatsoever. As Pema Chodron in her commentary says, our actions lead to happiness or grief, but our usual understanding of how this works is misguided. We think, for instance, that saving our money will make us wealthy, and giving too generously will make us poor. In this and the following verses, Shantideva turns this everyday logic upside down. He begins in verse 125, that's the verse we've just read, by pointing out that richness is a state of mind. Giving freely is the way of heaven. Holding back increases neediness and fear. The Tibetan teachings tell us the story of a beggar who, while scrabbling around in the trash one day, found a diamond. In himself, he was very contented with his lot, so he wondered to whom he could give this precious gem. Eventually, he went to the king, told him how he found the diamond, and offered it to him. "Why do you give this to me? You're a poor man. Why don't you use it?" asked the king. "Oh, I'm happy. I have no need," said the beggar. "However, although you are very rich, you are never satisfied. You're always looking for more, and that is why I'm giving this to you." And in this story, who's the rich man and who's the beggar? And now Shantideva shows the results of a self-cherishing attitude compared with an attitude of cherishing others. He says, "If for my own sake I cause harm to others, I shall be tormented in hellish realms. But if for the sake of others I cause harm to myself, I shall acquire all that is magnificent. By holding myself in high esteem, I shall find myself in unpleasant realms, ugly and stupid. But should this attitude be shifted to others, I shall acquire honors in a joyful realm. If I employ others for my own purposes, I myself shall experience servitude. But if I use myself for the sake of others, I shall experience only lordliness." He makes the fundamental Buddhist argument that when we cause harm to other beings with a self-serving motivation, we will inevitably get a very unpleasant karmic comeback. His Holiness the Dalai Lama writes, "If we harm and impoverish others to further our own interests, we shall be reborn in lower realms, such as the hells. On the other hand, if we forget ourselves in order to benefit others, if we are prepared to give our own lives to save the lives of others, giving whatever is necessary for their welfare, then we shall gain happiness and all perfection. The result of wishing to be superior to others, to be famous, will be lower rebirth or rebirth as an idiot, in abject misery with an ugly body. On the other hand, true humility, treating others as more important than ourselves, will lead to our being reborn in the higher realms, where we will be respected and influential. If we force others to work for us and serve us, inconsiderately abusing them, in future rebirths, we shall end up as their servants, or even their servants' servants. Whereas, if it is we who spend our lives serving others, we shall be reborn as kings and leaders. These, then, are the benefits to be gained from regarding others is more important than oneself, and the disadvantages of giving oneself precedence. Pema Chodron points out, however, that when Shanti Deva says, "But if for the sake of others I cause harm to myself," that he's mainly talking about undergoing hardships for the sake of others, not necessarily physically harming oneself. And she concurs with His Holiness when she writes, "The result of this is happiness. Wanting only what is best for ourselves and using others for our own profit results in our own suffering." Which is summarized in the next verse, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama often quotes. "Whatever joy there is in the world all comes from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in the world all comes from desiring myself to be happy." Pema Chodron uses a famous 1993 film to illustrate the point. I think Shantideva would have appreciated the film Groundhog Day because it illustrates verse 129 so perfectly, she writes in her commentary. "An angry man lives one day over and over again until he gets it right. He tries every possible selfish strategy for happiness, which only increases his frustration and discontent. Finally, he begins spending his day helping people. Why? Not to be seen as a good guy, but because it's the only thing that brings him pleasure. Every day, he catches the same little boy falling out of a tree, and every day, the little boy runs off without saying thank you. Every morning, he tries to save the life of a homeless man he's come to love, and every day, he doesn't succeed. But as this day is relived again and again, he becomes more flexible and warm-hearted, and people, understandably, come to love him." As Shantideva says, the more we benefit others, the more happiness comes our way. An even more modern reflection on this theme comes from an article in a blog I recently read by award-winning author and scientist Mick Farris, in which he talks about discovering new technologies. He writes this: "We have a part of our company that strives to gain a deeper understanding. They know things really, really, really well. Admittedly, these are some of the smartest people I've ever had the honor to work with. However, they have a hard time describing what they know to others, or even how to turn what they know into something that might be useful. We have another part of our company that strives to develop new capabilities. They focus on the people who are interested in what they're working on, and they turn their knowledge into beneficial products that can be easily understood and are useful. Of course, it's always incredibly important to strive to know more or to create new innovations that do things that have never been done before. But for our efforts to have true impact, they need to be geared towards benefiting others. While significant energy can be exerted in gaining new knowledge or demonstrating a new capability or invention, an equal amount of energy is needed to present these new insights into benefits for other people. Otherwise, our initial efforts in gaining the new knowledge might ultimately be lost. One such example is the comparison between the contributions of British scientists Sir Humphry Davy and those of American inventor Thomas Edison. By connecting two charcoal sticks to powerful battery technology he invented, Davy demonstrated the capability of using electricity to generate light. Davy had developed many other lamps, including candle-based safety lamps used by miners. But the demonstration of his powerful arc lamp to the Royal Society in 1809 was the first of its kind, a brand new innovation. Thomas Edison, on the other hand, strove to make the light bulb practical, thus benefiting others. 70 years later, after Davy's demonstration, Edison took advantage of the rush to create practical light bulbs using a method called incandescence, which refers to light being emitted from a hot metal object due to its temperature. As a result of thousands of attempts on Edison's part, he created an incandescent light bulb that lasted for 40 hours, and then later improved the design to last for over 1,200 hours. Now, by the electrical light bulbs that illuminate nearly every home and office in the world, we remember Edison. In fact, many people think that Edison actually invented the electric light bulb itself, leaving Davy's contributions, while significant, deep in our collective memories. I don't know how many times I've heard in my occupation that people want to be recognized for their great ideas. They sometimes ask, how are we going to recognize the scientist that comes up with the next $100 million idea for our company? However, even I sometimes fall into this trap myself. What I tell my colleagues is that it doesn't matter how great your idea is. It matters what you do with it. And what you do with it needs to benefit others. Other people need to understand why your innovative concept or capability will make their lives better. Your work may explain something that others have never understood before. So, not only should your work provide that answer, it needs to explain that answer in such a way that it's clear to others. One way to think about your efforts is to think of what you are providing and ask, what am I producing or what product am I creating that others will find useful? If your goal is to gain understanding, you need to communicate that understanding to others. The product is the understanding and the communication of that understanding. If your goal is to provide a new capability, you need to present it in a way that is useful to others. The product is the new capability and communicating the way that others can use the new capability to benefit their lives. In the end, when you benefit others, others will return the favor and recognize you for your contributions. That's how to make a lasting impact within the science and technology fields. Thus spake Nick Farris, and how's that for advice to make your work meaningful? Shantideva now sums up with a comparison between ordinary people and Buddhas. He writes, but what need is there to say much more? The childish work for their own benefit, the Buddhas work for the benefit of others. Just look at the difference between them. The difference between an ordinary person like myself and a Buddha is the misunderstanding of reality. Basically, the misunderstanding of how the self exists. Buddhas have experientially and completely understood that they have no inherent independent self whatsoever, and so they are free of any self-cherishing. Well, how can you cherish a self when it exists only as a dependent and ever-changing phenomenon? Not only that, seeing that unenlightened beings, by believing the opposite, cause themselves infinite unnecessary suffering, the Buddhas have infinite compassion and work intensely to relieve them of their misery. Ordinary beings have the delusion that somewhere in their makeup is a real and independent self. Some might call it a soul that is really themselves. This self needs never-ending protection and cherishing because it constantly comes into contact with other real independent selves who might be either friendly or hostile. So while the Buddhas with no self to worry about are only concerned with helping others, ordinary beings out of their self-grasping and cherishing think mainly of helping themselves. In terms of suffering, Buddhas have none at all, while us ordinary beings are drowning in a great sea of dissatisfaction and misery. And this is the difference between us and the Buddhas. But to the extent that we understand this, we can slowly work towards freeing ourselves of self-absorption and turn our thoughts outwards, as the man in Groundhog Day did. The more we can turn our minds towards benefiting others, the less self-centered we will become, and the better the opportunity we will have to progress to Buddhahood. And even our present life will become happier. So says Shantideva in his next verse. If I do not actually exchange my happiness for the suffering of others, I shall not attain the state of Buddhahood, and even in cyclic existence shall have no joy. Let alone what is beyond this world, because of my servants doing no work and because of my masters giving me no pay, even the needs of this life will not be fulfilled. His Holiness comments that our greatest enemy is to consider ourselves more important than others and leads us and others to certain ruin. From our attachment to the self, the I, all harm, fear and suffering in this world arises, he says. Pema Chodron follows the Padmakara translation, which in verse 132 reads a little more coherently than the Stephen Batchelor translation I'm using. It goes, leaving future lives outside the reckoning, even this life's needs are not fulfilled. When servants do not do their work and masters do not pay the wages earned. And Pema Chodron glosses it like this. Forget about enlightenment. Even worldly joy will elude us if we don't care for one another. In this life, if servants or employees don't do their work, and masters or employers have no concern for them, then the values of society begin to break down. Verse 132 is the story behind all revolutions. I think of South Africa when I read it. For years, cruel masters didn't pay the wages earned. Apartheid or separateness was legalized and deeply ingrained. Yet many people worked with the same principles Shantideva is proclaiming, and eventually something shifted for the better. As a result of years of oppression, however, the former servants now attack the former masters. This is a familiar story. The roles of the oppressor and the oppressed switch back and forth. Lasting happiness, Shantideva says, depends on a true shift in the human heart, one that begins with wanting what is best for others because we see the joys and sorrows as our own. Now, while of course that last sentence hits the nail right on the head, I think her choice of South Africa as an example is a little disingenuous. You will probably have noticed that I have a South African accent. And yes, I was born and raised in South Africa and Zimbabwe under the apartheid system. I left in 1975, before it all came to an end. But I did expect that the system would eventually come crashing down with lots of hatred and bloodshed. In fact, as history has shown, much to the influence of Nelson Mandela, aided by F.W. de Klerk, the transition to a majority rules democracy was much less bloody, much more peaceful than I think many expected. The establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was an extraordinary step, especially in the dark continent Africa, towards resolving the terrible wounds and scars caused by apartheid. And it's surprising how much the former servants did not attack the former masters, but how many set about trying to work together for a satisfactory future for the country. The last time I was in South Africa to visit my family in 2006, that intention was quite evident when I talked to both white and black people. Of course, things did not turn rosy overnight, and there are still horrendous problems with very complex causes in South Africa. Many can be attributed to the continuing wide-ranging disparity between the rich and poor in the country. Huddled close against the gated and walled-off mansion, swimming pool and tennis courts of a millionaire, you may well find, as I did in 2006, a congregation of tin shanties with open drains. The difference now is that the mansion may easily belong to a black man, where it could only have been a white man's before. And white families may live in the shanties where only blacks would have existed before. Whether such a disparity can be fully laid at the door of apartheid is really moot, because if you look at the rest of Africa, not all that much is different. Rulers in many African countries have amassed very large bank accounts and live in palaces, while their people sleep in mud huts and work in abject poverty. The actual point is that for a beautiful and resources-wealthy country like South Africa to flourish and best serve its inhabitants, people must work harmoniously together, no one oppressing anyone else, whether white dominating black, black dominating white, or masters of any color oppressing servants of any color. The only difference to the system, if black rulers take over from whites and use the country as their own personal estate, will be in name, never mind the approval of overseas concerns. Anyway, this isn't a forum to solve the problems of Africa's most southerly country. So now let's get back to Shantideva. He writes, "By rejecting the method that establishes both foreseeable and unforeseeable joy, I cast magnificent delight completely aside. And then, because of inflicting misery on others, in confusion I seize hold of unbearable pain." The method he refers to is cherishing others more than oneself, which, as he has pointed out, brings happiness in both this and future lives. If we only follow our own desires, he repeats, and bring harm to others out of our selfishness, we throw away our opportunity for both temporary and ultimate happiness and create the causes for an ongoing misery we will find very hard to bear. If all the injury, fear, and pain in this world arise from grasping at a self, then what use is that great ghost to me? If I do not completely forsake it, I shall be unable to put an end to suffering, just as I cannot avoid being burnt if I do not cast aside the fire I hold. And here we come again to the point I made earlier about grasping at a real independent self. All the misery in the world, all the fear we and other beings experience, come from this tightly held idea that somewhere we have such a self. Never mind that if we are asked to describe it or show where it resides, we can do neither, we still believe with very little doubt that it exists. It's like a ghost, says Shantideva, for although it appears very real, if you try to touch it, your hand goes right through, and you cannot say whether it is really there or not. His Holiness talks about it as a great demon, for it is the source of all our suffering. And Shantideva also says that unless we cannot totally renounce it, totally realize that it does not exist in any shape or form, we will not be able to free ourselves from suffering. Just as when we hold an ember in our hand, we will definitely be burnt unless we quickly throw it away. As Pema Chodron says, when we play with fire, we cannot escape from being burned. This describes life in the cocoon. The more self-absorbed we are, the more we suffer. But we can't just snap our fingers and say, this I is just a label. I'm not going to think that way anymore. Our ego trips are deeply ingrained. They are, in fact, the very means that keep the six realms oiled and running. So how do we get out of this? As Shantideva has said again and again, seeing the sameness of ourselves is the key. In one of his lectures, Thich Nhat Hanh compared us to lotus seeds. Each of you is a seed, a wonderful seed like the seed of a lotus, he writes. You look a little bit bigger than a lotus seed, but you are a wonderful seed. In you are a lot of talents. Compassion is in you. Understanding is in you. Love is in you. The capacity to smile is in you. The capacity to help other people is in you. Because these wonderful virtues, these wonderful qualities have been transmitted to you by your ancestors, your blood ancestors and your spiritual ancestors. If you know how to sprout and grow, you will be a very beautiful lotus pond, and you will offer a lot of happiness to many, many people around you. Not only people, but animals, plants, and minerals. And he goes on, we have so many kinds of wonderful seeds within us, and if we know how to help the seeds to sprout, we'll be happy, and we'll be able to offer a lot of happiness to so many people. We already have a lot of good seeds within us, and we continue to receive seeds. When I look at you with loving eyes and with the eyes of trust and admiration, a good seed is planted within you. I help to plant a seed of faith, of confidence, of compassion in you, just by looking at you with the eyes of love and compassion. And we can help each other by planting the positive and beautiful seeds in each other. Every sound you hear can be a seed, a good seed or a negative seed. Every sight you see can be received as a seed in yourself, a positive seed or a negative seed. That is from his book, All in One, One in All. And with that, it's time to say goodbye for another week. Thank you for joining the program today, and may you do so next week. Please dedicate any positive energy we've created to your purpose, particularly to the enlightenment of all beings. Thank you, and have a wonderful week. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering.
wellness weather report.